ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Christopher and Pixie Skase flaunted their wealth.
27 white limousines and the champagne flowed.
It couldn't be bigger than Pixie's blonde hair.
Spending other people's money, and when they were found out, Pixie paid the price.
A sort of gilded cage that she was a prisoner in.
I'm Mark Humphreys. To binge the full series now, search for ABC Rewind and look for Skase, Fall of a Tycoon on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, I'm Tegan Taylor and this is Life Matters, where your stories shape the national conversation. 4 years on from the Aged Care Royal Commission report being handed down, a major change arrived over the weekend. One of the Commission's cornerstone reforms came into effect, a new Aged Care Act. But what does it actually mean? What are your rights in aged care? And do these changes bring us closer to a system that we can truly trust to care for us and those who we love? Also ahead, what did school lunch look like when you were a kid and how does it compare to what today's kids are eating? Because public primary schools are hiring chefs, tuck shops are struggling and teachers are paying for kids' lunches out of their own pockets. Lunchtime is a growing challenge for Aussie schools. It's all coming up here on ABC Radio National. But first, the stories you've been hearing out of early childhood centres last week, this whole year really have been horrific. And if you're dropping your little ones or your grandkids off today, one of the things that might reassure you that it's all going to be okay is when you get a notification a few hours into the day, that little window on your phone that says a new story has been added to your centre's app. And you click through and you see that little face and it's covered in sand or paint or biscuit crumbs, and you know that they're having a great time. You can see that they're safe and happy with your own eyes as their educators snap pictures of the day's activities and upload them to the app, which is lovely. But some parents are finding that when your child graduates to big school, their data doesn't automatically go with them. When you enroll your kid in a daycare these days, there's an app for everything, and it's not just photos of your kids either. You have to upload sensitive documents like birth certificates. So where does the responsibility for protecting this data lie and how do parents navigate it? If you've got experience with these apps, either in daycare or in school, I'd love to know how you found it, if you liked being able to see live updates from your kids, or if you're worried about who else might be able to see them too. With me is Niels Wouters. He's a Melbourne parent and he's also a privacy and technology ethics researcher. Niels, I can't think of anyone more qualified to have this chat this morning.
Thanks for having me, Tegan.
So you've been trying to get your son's data removed for a while. What kind of data is on these apps?
Yeah, so that's right. So I think we're currently in sort of 10 months into the journey of trying to get his data removed. And in terms of the data that's on there, it's literally everything that you can imagine in terms of the data that gets produced while a child is attending childcare. So that includes, I guess, the number of nappies changed and what time of the day they have been changed, in case you're interested. What's been eaten for lunch and how much he's eaten and what he's left behind when he's napped, and to the point where you mentioned previously, indeed, birth certificate, contact details, emergency contact details, health history, literally everything.
So when you first took him to daycare, were you like, oh, this is so cute, it's nice to be able to know, or like, it's good to know that he ate all his lunch today, or he didn't have a nap, I know what to prepare for? Was that something that you were valuing?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. You know, those first few months or first few years, really, and he's six, so it's probably still an ongoing journey, but those first few years are wild, right? Like, you want to know, first of all, where is my son or where is my child? Is he having fun? Is he having a nice day? But also, what are we getting back at the end of the day? You know, is he going to be exhausted? Is he going to be tired? Probably all of the above, really. But you want to have that sort of near real-time contact, I suppose. And it's something that we as adults have become so accustomed to, right? Like, we're all on our mobile phones, we're all on our social networks. This is the sort of almost logical continuation of what we've created for ourselves, but then applied to our little ones.
So he's finished daycare now. He's at school, yep, as you said, and you wanted to get this data removed, and it's not been a straightforward process.
It's absolutely not been a straightforward journey. And look, for us, making sure that there are no remnants of data left behind, it's important. It's not a deal breaker, absolutely not. But I think my wife and I, we've tried really early on, so sort of January this year, we've started that process with the childcare centre and said, hey, our son has had an absolute fantastic 5 years here. Can we now make sure that, first of all, you know, our accounts are closed, there's no outstanding invoices, and oh yeah, also, we've been through the journey here with you using three apps over the course of 5 years. Can we just make sure that our user accounts are closed and all of the data that is no longer needed, can we just make sure that that's been removed? Initially, the childcare center said, yep, great, we've sent an email to our software vendor. So we were like, excellent, great. We gave it a couple of weeks, a couple of months. But sadly, we noticed that all of our accounts remained active and all of the data remained on there. And that was literally the same data that was on there on the day that our son left childcare. So yeah, numerous back and forths. We also sent emails to the software vendor who then said, look, we can't act on your behalf, even though it's your data or your son's data. We can only act on behalf of the childcare center. So the childcare center has to give us the heads up that they're fine with the data being removed. But in the same email, they also sent a memo to the childcare center saying that legally, supposedly, they're not required to remove the data. And they pointed to a handbook that the federal government has published in terms of how, you know, how data has to be managed at childcare centres or how childcare centres should operate. Now, part of that document does indeed say that some data has to be retained in terms of making sure that your CCS payments were valid, but that doesn't mean everything, and it doesn't mean when the nappies have been changed, and it doesn't mean what's been eaten for lunch, it doesn't mean photos, it doesn't even mean a birth certificate. There just needs to be a record that the identity of the child and or the parents has at some point been validated, has been checked, and that's absolutely happened. So look, we're now sort of 9 or 10 months into the journey. The data is still on there. I logged on again yesterday. My wife logged on again yesterday evening as well. Everything remains on there. And probably most shockingly, I think the birth certificate of my son is behind a public web link. It's not secured in any way, shape or form. And don't get me wrong, this is a very complex URL. It's not a very straightforward URL. So it's quite complicated. But
it's there.
But it's there, and I think a person who is more technically inclined than I am could probably find a way to download such data. It would be illegal, don't get me wrong, but it is there. And I think in Australia, we just have, yeah, a history of cyber breaches. And for me, this is not a moment of if this is going to happen. I'm pretty confident that at some point this will happen. And I'm just really worried that that data gets out there. Not just my son's data, don't get me wrong. I think this applies to hundreds of thousands of young Australians. And that data is just so poorly protected at the moment.
You are listening to Life Matters here on ABC Radio National. I'm Tegan Taylor. The voice you've just been hearing is that of Niels Wouters. He's a Melbourne parent. He's also a technology and ethics researcher. Just on the process it's taken to try to get his son's information taken off the apps that was shared with him while he was a parent, while his child was at daycare. His kid's now at school. And it's been much more complicated than he realised to get that data taken down. On the text line, Greg says, we're on an app for our grandchildren's daycare. All well and good to see them enjoying the activities, but so many photos, and often mostly of other kids. Well, also with me is Lucy Pangrazio, who's an associate professor at Deakin University and chief investigator at the Centre for the Digital Child. Lucy, these apps have had a fairly steep rise in Australia.
Yes, that's right, Tegan. I think some of them came about in the early 2010s, but then during the pandemic, they really did expand. And now we've seen, you know, huge kind of spread across the sector, really, with these all-in-one type of platforms.
Whose responsibility is to manage the sensitive data? Because I was really surprised to hear Niels say before that that when he asked for when he asked the app directly to take his son's information down, they actually said that effectively he's not the client, the daycare's the client, and that some of this information is required to stay there. How tricky is this maze of who's the actual client here?
Yeah, it is really tricky, and we've done some investigation into the privacy policy of some of these apps and found that actually the language is very vague, and when you do a deep dive, you can actually see that some of this data is being shared pretty widely with a whole host of third parties, including Google Analytics and Facebook, a whole range, even YouTube, and then a whole lot of AI service providers as well. So I imagine what that means is that that data is sort of really just gathers a life of its own. So even though it's the responsibility should really lie with the platform, it ends up spreading out across a whole range of third parties. And then that onus is put back onto the user, essentially, to kind of be accountable, and that might be the centre. So I guess the point is it's quite vague as to who's actually accountable and responsible for managing this data.
Lucy, I do want to talk to you about what you know about what parents' attitudes are as well. But for you, as someone who researches this, you're literally in a place called the Centre for the Digital Child. What's your response when you realise sort of how far this data's travelled to AI companies, etc.?
I think it's quite shocking, and we were quite shocked as researchers as well. And look, I think it's a really complicated situation because many of these platforms start with really good intentions. The founders have the best of intentions, but what happens is the company grows and it becomes valuable, and then the sort of business model means that they lose control, essentially, of this really sensitive information. So I think a lot of parents don't have the time to read the privacy policy. A lot of the childcare sector isn't probably not suitably prepared to work in these environments and understand the kinds of obligations that go with these technologies. And so I think we're in a situation where, as Niels has sort of beautifully captured, who's accountable ultimately for our kids' data, there will be changes next year when we hope that the Children's Online Privacy Code comes in, and that might put the onus back on the service providers to actually be a bit more accountable. But at the moment, I think it's very grey, and it is quite shocking as a researcher in this space.
You are about to hear from someone from the Australian Childcare Alliance, but briefly, Lucy, what are parents' attitudes towards this? Is there an expectation that they will be able to have all this information on tap via an app?
To be honest, I think a lot of parents do feel reassured, as you were sort of explaining before. They feel reassured to see photos of their children. We had one educator tell us his story about a parent who called them during the day and said, you know, is my child okay? My husband dropped him off. I haven't seen him in the photo feed today. I'm just wondering if he's still there. And the educator described this as quite a common practice and this proof of life, she described it as. So, you know, that the anxieties, I guess, are allayed, but also, you know, increased through these apps. So, what comes next will be interesting.
Nesha Hutchinson is Vice President of the Australian Childcare Alliance, which is a peak body for childcare providers in the country. Nesha, I'm hearing Lucy tell this story about basically parents asking for photos when you're already juggling so many kids. What's the expectation like, and how are childcare centres handling it?
Great question, Tegan. It's an interesting development, as Lucy said, particularly in the last few years, with parents who, as she said, this proof of life, my goodness, what's going on? And there is research that's starting to come out that says that these constant alerts and updates and things don't actually relieve the anxiety. It actually creates more anxiety for families because, as Lucy was just saying, my goodness, I haven't had an update in the last 10 minutes. There must be something wrong. And it's difficult when you're working with children to keep these real-time updates going live. And anecdotally, we've had heard of centres who are going back to just pen and paper updates. And at the end of the day, you know, we'll call you if there's a problem and we'll call you to let you know that your child is okay. But you can get this information at the end of the day rather than these real-time updates that are putting it's putting a lot of pressure on educators. And although I know families feel like it's making them relieve their anxiety, the studies are coming out showing it over time it actually increases it.
What about the sensitivity, the concerns around the storage of sensitive data? How are centres handling that?
As Neil said, there's we are required to keep certain information for certain periods of time. And in some cases, best practice for some bits of information is to keep that information for up to 45 years. And in the past, it was all paper records, and it was easy. You'd go through after 3 years and take away the information that you no longer need, and go through after 7 years, take out further information, and then the other information you need to keep for 25 years and throw in a good old archive box and stick it in the attic. There is no protocol to destroy information, hard copy or not, and with these apps coming on, again, this is all relatively new, and so there isn't really a protocol around that. I know that hard copies are sufficient, that it doesn't have to be stored digitally, or that you can store it, for example, burn it to, for example, a DVD or a CD or something, and store that. But Niels is right, there isn't protocol around when and where and why and how to destroy this data and how to get it back off the World Wide Web. But, I mean, if Lucy's saying that there's a children's online privacy code coming out, that's possibly going to address some of that.
Here on ABC Radio National, you're listening to Life Matters. I'm Tegan Taylor with Nesha Hutchinson, who's the Vice President of the Australian Childcare Alliance, as well as Lucy Pangrazio, Associate Professor at the Deakin University and Chief Investigator at the Centre for the Digital Child, and Niels Wouters, who's a Melbourne parent who was looking at trying to get his kids' data off the daycare centre's apps, third-party apps, once his child left the daycare centre. Lucy, thinking about Niels's point and then also what we're hearing Nesha say, is it realistic for parents to opt out of these apps entirely if that's what they want to do?
I think it's really hard. We spoke to a number of parents, but a couple who did not feel comfortable about these apps. But you know, for one parent, for example, who was actually in tech themselves, had no social media, but felt that when their child entered childcare, they had no choice but to sign up to these apps. And they made that compromise. And, you know, as researchers, we were just really interested in this sense of sort of being forced into it and having very little alternative, no alternative really. And, you know, many of these platforms are like social media feeds. So, you know, if you are ethically opposed to, or you're not interested in being on social media and you have a small child, then you sort of end up being on there anyway because they are part of the enrolment process.
So, Niels, you took your issues with these apps to the next level. You've made a complaint to the Office of the Australian Information Commissioner. What's happened there?
So far, nothing has happened. So we filed that report, I think, late August, because that was the sort of 6 month mark, and we thought, like, this is a reasonable time frame, you know, for the key information to be removed. So far, we haven't heard back. So that report is in. I've been told that can take several months. In the meantime, we keep checking for our data and making sure that it's still on there. Occasionally, I keep looking at those platforms, or the one platform in particular that we still have ongoing issues with. Looking at the app and just remain shocked about the level of private information that is on there, kids' names, kids' photos, et cetera, et cetera. But I think at the moment we're in this, really weird situation where we as parents, my wife and I, we don't really know what else to do. We keep speaking to other parents who, many parents surprisingly, haven't really paid attention. And they're like, oh, is that a thing? Is the data, does the data really stay on there? And they go and check in the evening, you know, after we've caught up, and they're like, oh my goodness. There's data from my son who's been out of care for the last 3 or 4 years, and it's still on there. All these photos are still on there. So I think it's really important that as a society we just understand that if our data is on these apps, the fact that your child leaves childcare doesn't automatically mean the data is removed. So something stays there. So there is some form of a digital footprint. As Lucy said as well, that data is clearly shared with other providers. And yeah, I think that's something for us all to be very conscious of. Mm-hmm. Some people might want it or some people might not mind. But we as a family, we do mind. Yeah.
We did reach out to the Office of the Australian Information Commissioner, and it said that although the OAIC does not comment on individual complaints, it had received some complaints related to apps used by schools and childcare centres. The statement said, while we won't comment on the particularities of those matters, it should be noted that under the Privacy Act, there is not currently an absolute right to request one's personal information be destroyed or erased. However, the OAIC is currently drafting the Children's Online Privacy Code, which will expand on the existing requirements of the Privacy Act as it relates to children's personal information. The statement says the OAIC is exploring including online services that process significant amounts of children's information, like apps used by schools and childcare centres, in the scope of the code. And that statement will be on the Life Matters website. Niels, if you had your time again, would you have consented to using these apps?
Oh, that's a very good question. Like, I think we ticked so many consent boxes, you know, when we first signed up. I can't remember whether or not the app was an option to begin with. So I think it's just made really hard for parents to opt out. And I think as parents, it's this constant battle, this sort of inner battle. Like, yes, I want to know how my kid is doing. I want to know they're safe. I want to know they're having fun. I want to know they're learning something. But at the same time, indeed, if all these apps create is a significant digital footprint, I'd rather opt out and go back to pen and paper. I think childcare centres have a really rich history of doing that really well. I'm very conscious that it's extra work and extra workload. But I also, like I said to my wife and other families, like, I don't want childcare centres to become tech support or tech professionals. That's not their job. I'd rather them focus on kids. So if now all of a sudden they have this extra worry around removal of data, I'd rather them not worry about it or have to worry about it.
Niels, Lucy, Nesha, thank you all so much for joining me today. Niels Wouters is a Melbourne parent and a privacy and technology ethics researcher. Lucy Pangrazio is an associate professor at Deakin University and chief investigator at the Centre for the Digital Child. And Nesha Hutchinson is vice president of the Australian Childcare Alliance. And thank you for your texts too. One from someone who works in community preschool that's rated as exceeding the quality standard. They say, we don't use these apps due to privacy and safety concerns, and also the time to manage and upload photos and updates. There's no consideration of children's rights at all. We'd rather spend our time educating the children and communicating with parents face-to-face. These apps are not required for quality childcare, but well-certified, well-qualified, experienced and engaged educators are. Well, coming up next here on Life Matters on ABC Radio National, aged care reforms came into effect over the weekend. What will they actually mean?
Ever since Beef Wellington became a murder weapon, I've been wondering, what's up with mushrooms? Hello, Anne Jones here from What the Duck, and I'm trying to work out why would fungi be so poisonous that it can kill you? And death caps in particular, why are you so apparently delicious? What do you want, to be eaten or not? To find out, search for What the Duck and look for mushrooms. Find it wherever you get your podcasts or on the ABC Listen app.
We trust the aged care system to look after our loved ones as if they were family. And that's why the stories of abuse and neglect uncovered during the Aged Care Royal Commission were so heartbreaking. Well, 4 years on from that report, a major change has arrived. On Saturday, one of the Commission's cornerstone reforms came into effect, the new Aged Care Act. It's meant to streamline legislation and processes, and most importantly, it includes a new statement of rights designed to put people at the centre of the aged care system. But what does that mean for you and your family? What are your rights in aged care? And do these changes bring us closer to a system that we can truly trust to care for our loved ones and ourselves? Tell me what your experience has been. Have you seen changes in the care that you or your parents are receiving in the aged care system. Lisa Backhouse gave evidence to the Royal Commission about the substandard level of care her mum experienced while in care. Lisa, welcome to Life Matters.
Good morning, Tegan.
So I do want to get your reflections on these changes in a minute, but do you mind talking a bit about your mum and the events that led you to front up to the Royal Commission?
Yeah, sure. Look, mum had a very long and difficult journey in aged care. She was in the system for the best part of a decade. That started as very much a low-care situation for her. Back when she went into care, there was such a thing as low-care and high-care. Pardon me. So she started her journey in low-care, and by the time she progressed to a point, she had vascular dementia, so by the time she progressed to a point of needing high care, the facility had actually morphed with her, if you like, over time. And the vast majority of people in there were high care. The centre was locked down. You needed a code to get in, and it was a very different place. Look, mum did have vascular dementia. She struggled toward the end. I guess it's hard to wrap a lot of time into a very short couple of sentences for you, but to cut a long story short, she had an unwitnessed fall at her aged care facility. That the sensor light wasn't on. She was on the floor for a very long time. When I got into hospital, the nurses pulled me aside and showed me her incontinence pad, which was absolutely disgusting. The ambulance officers had pointed it out to them when they got there because the stench was so vile. She had been trying to mobilise at the aged care home because of that and ended up having a terrible fall. Her leg was smashed. When I got back to get her the next day, she was on her bed, she was covered in urine, she was in distress and pain. I went down to confront the nurses in the station. There was a whole bunch of people standing around chatting. I asked some questions such as, when was the last time mum had medication, please? She's in pain. She was given a couple of Panadol 4 hours ago, and I'm talking about a smashed leg, Tegan. It wasn't just a little fracture in any case. It was severely broken. She wasn't receiving the care that she needed there. It was neglectful. I was told that I was bullying the staff by asking some of those basic questions. So the abuse sort of stretches really from, can stretch from the patient to the families when you do start to ask questions and when you do start to stand up as an advocate for your relative. I flew into panic mode and went, resigned my job and went out to find another nursing home for mum, which was no mean feat because the aged care providers don't like to take people with high needs. They're more costly, they're more work, they're more bothersome. But I was very lucky I found somewhere closer to home and a very caring nurse manager at this particular facility. And she took us in and I was very grateful for that. But the experience that we had there, which was also another major organisation and provider, was equally as bad, if not worse. Mum ended up being assaulted by a carer on two separate occasions, and they were both, pretty awful assaults. She was left on the floor there for long periods of time. She wasn't treated in the manner with which you would hope that a loved one would be treated. I ended up putting a surveillance camera in her room with the permission of the nurse manager at the time, because she understood, but she was promptly got rid of. And then, there was a lot of pressure on me to remove the camera and to move from that facility to go somewhere else because they didn't like that I was, watching them and caring. And so if there was an incident, I would watch mum and I would pick up the phone and I would ring the station and I would say, please. She's been in bed since 8 o'clock last night. She hasn't had any water. I can see her. She's not, she's not eaten. Can someone please go and get her up? Can someone please give her a drink? Can someone please change her pad? Can someone please give her some help? So, look, it was, for me, a very traumatic period of my life. It's one that I've tried to, recover from. But I know that there are many, many, many Australians still going through this. I still get approached by people. The young girl at my work who has confided in me recently that she's going through a similar situation with her mum. So it's still happening. It's a complex system. It's a big system. It's a system where you lose your power. There's a huge power imbalance between these very large businesses and families. And let's face it, you know, by the time your relative gets into a high care facility, they cannot advocate on their behalf any longer. They are past that point. They need someone with eyes and ears and a loud voice on the ground to advocate on their behalf.
You're listening to Life Matters here on ABC Radio National. I'm Tegan Taylor talking with Lisa Backhouse, who is an aged care advocate. She was a participant in the Royal Commission into Aged Care, telling the story of her mum, which you just heard a small slice of there. And Lisa, I do want to come back to you in a second, but also with me is Deborah Nicol, who's the CEO of Elder Rights Australia. And Deborah, just listening to Lisa's mum's story there, it makes it pretty clear why this new statement of rights for aged care is so important.
Yes. Good morning, Tegan, and good morning to your listeners. Lisa's story is just horrible. I find it really hard to listen to, as I'm sure everyone else does, and I'm so sorry that Lisa, and particularly her mother, had to go through that at a time in her life where she should have been cared for, cherished and appreciated.
So tell me about what this new statement of rights enshrines in law that we didn't have before.
Well, Tegan, the old Act now, I can say, the old Charter of Aged Care Rights was in the principles, so the user rights principles of the Aged Care Act. The new statement of rights is included in the primary legislation. So providers must ensure that their actions are consistent with this statement and that they are upholding the rights of those whom they are caring for. The rights or the duties, that they are enforceable by proceedings in a court or tribunal. Now, this will need to be tested, of course, because the Act is very new. But that is a big step forward. There are six rights, and they are based on two international rights conventions, the International Covenant on Economic, Social and Cultural Rights and the Convention on Rights of Persons with Disabilities. So we are hoping, and look, it's a start, but there is a long way to go, as Lisa's story and others' story clearly indicates.
What will it actually mean in practice for people in the system and for their families?
Well, it will mean that they can go back and say, look, you're not, this is one of the rights, I think it's about the fifth right, is about being person-centred. The care must be person-centred or person-led. So the older person and or their representative decides what care and services they receive, who provides them, and that they are, if the older person has some form of cognitive impairment, like Lisa's mum in the end, then they are supported in their decision-making. The power balance will shift. And very interesting, Lisa, talking about power imbalance. That is what we hear on a daily basis from family who assert their parents' rights, usually, or their loved ones' rights, and they're accused of being aggressive. Now we can go back to the rights, the statement of rights, and say, no, hang on a minute, this older person has a right to receive care that is safe, that is of a quality, that is trauma-informed and respectful and delivered by qualified, well-trained staff. So I think this, certainly as independent advocates, we will be holding this statement, and as we did with the previous charter, but it will have more weight. But, Tegan, we need a culture shift. And I don't just mean in aged care, a culture shift across the community about how we value and care for older people.
Lisa, listening to that, given your experience, does that sound like it's going to make a material change?
Look, I do tend to agree that
anything is better than what we had. So I think that it will – look, it's a start. I think it is a start in the right direction, but I guess my concern is what it will mean in a practical sense on the ground. I agree that the culture shift and the respect for our elderly people is long overdue. I'm hoping that this is a step in the right direction. But, you know, there could be some really perverse outcomes from this as well, Tegan. Mm-hmm. You know, the onus under the Act is now on providers to lift the bar. And you get, again, remember these are big businesses. So the perverse outcome here could be that we actually disincentivise providers from taking high needs and dementia patients. Because if they're now going to be held, you know, to enforce certain standards, and I'd be very interested to see if these are enforceable in court or a tribunal. I know that under the Act it says you can complain to the Commissioner. Well, we could always complain to the Commissioner. They have some strength and powers, but I will be, you know, it will be very interesting to see if it plays out in a court. But I do feel that it does, putting the onus back on providers to raise the standards. I mean, it's not high needs people who people with high needs are the ones who need to go into care, right? A lot of what's come through here is trying to keep people in their own homes, you know, under this package. It's about the stay-at-home packages. It's about keeping people in their own homes. Well, the people with high needs are the ones who need to go into care. It's not an option for them to stay at home and be supported by the system there. So if we're incentivising, if we're telling providers to lift the bar and they know they need to do that or they're going to be held accountable, what's the incentive for them to take dementia patients and high needs patients? And where do those people then end up?
Here on Life Matters on ABC Radio National, I'm Tegan Taylor with Lisa Backhouse, who is an aged care advocate inspired in large part by the terrible experiences that her mum had in aged care, and Deborah Nicol, who's the CEO of Elder Rights Australia. And I'd love to know if this is a system that you've interacted with, what your experience has been. Randall in Canberra says the aged care system is designed for the frail aged. It's quite inadequate for the disabled with high care needs. The NDIS is designed to care for the disabled. However, unfortunately, the NDIS rejects people who become disabled after 65. They're now referred to aged care. Randall says the new system gives even less personal care than previously provided. We urgently need to look at the treatment of disabled people in aged care. It is such a complex and multi-layered issue, Deborah. What kind of legal avenues might people be able to go down? What sort of legal accountability would providers have if they're breaching this new Act?
Look, I'm not a lawyer, Tegan, for starters. So, yes, I can't comment too much on that. As we said, we really will need to test this new Act, and we really do need to know if people are having ongoing issues. What I can say is that we now have, by way of governance of aged care, a complaints commissioner, an independent complaints commissioner. So we've got the Aged Care Quality and Safety Commissioner, and we've got an independent complaints commissioner, just been appointed. We've also got an interim First Nations commissioner, an inspector general of aged care. They happen to all be women, just by coincidence, and they are all pretty committed, from what I can gather, to helping to change the system and to hold providers to account. And they're doing that by speaking to older people with lived experience. And I think that's key, to hear from people like Lisa who have had lived experience, to hear from older people who are currently living in residential aged care or receiving care at home. What is their experience? And amplifying that, and it will be a slow change. This is a massive cultural change across the community and across aged care, but it's a step that we have to take.
So, Deborah, listening to Lisa's story, it sounded like every step of the way was a fight, and not everyone has the ability to be as relentless. Where can they turn if they feel like they need help?
Well, I guess that's why Royal Commission Recommendation 106 was to make sure that aged care, independent aged care advocates, that there were more of us, that we were funded adequately, and we were able to respond and help address the power imbalance that Lisa has so clearly articulated that she experienced. Aged care advocates are there to provide independent information to empower informed decision making, provide direct advocacy support and stand beside the older person and their representative, at their direction, of course, and with their permission. We're also out there educating aged care staff on what it means to recognise the rights of the older person.
Well, Deborah, Lisa, thank you both so much for joining me. Deborah Nicol is CEO of Elder Rights Australia, and Lisa Backhouse sharing her story, how she's been advocating for changes to the aged care sector after such a negative experience with her mum. On the text line, one says, my late father was in aged care for the last 2 years of his life. He received exceptional care and loving compassion. My mother-in-law is currently in an aged care facility and she also receives amazing care. I have friends whose parents are in care and have the same good experiences. I'm not denying negative claims, but the media never talks about the good stories. We need to share good experiences. Well, I'm so glad to hear that those people are getting beautiful care as well. Coming up here on Life Matters on ABC Radio National, does Australia need a school lunch program in primary schools?
I'm nervous, are you?
Just 4 hours to paint your favourite celebrity.
I'm so scared right now, it doesn't matter.
You've got this.
Like Miff Warhurst, Adam Liao and Celia Pakwola.
Painting is like a battle.
Bang. Your time is up.
Artists, turn your easels.
That's me.
Who will be crowned winner of Portrait Artist of the Year?
Wow.
The clever people.
Sunday nights on ABC TV or stream all the episodes now on ABC iView.
What was in your lunchbox when you went to primary school? For me, it was a frozen popper, a sandwich and a piece of fruit. I was always jealous of the kids that got chips. Or sometimes on a special occasion, I'd sticky tape some coins to a brown paper bag for a meat pie from the tuck shop. Well, these days, school tuck shops are struggling. Teachers are paying for kids' lunches out of their own pockets, and some public primary schools are hiring chefs, and yet many kids are still going to school hungry and without lunch. So why is lunch a growing challenge for Australian schools, and is a national school lunch program the solution? In a moment, you'll hear from the principal of a primary school in Melbourne's north, where a chef prepares everyone's meals on site. You'll also hear from a researcher who's developing a lunch resource kit for schools. But tell me, what's lunch like at your kids' school or the school of the kids in your life? Is there a tuck shop? What was the last lunchbox you packed? Tell me what was in it. And with me is Beck Spink, principal of Werribee Primary School in Victoria, and Rebecca Golly, a professor of nutrition and dietetics at Flinders University. Rebecca's welcome.
Hi.
Beck, tell me about the school. Your school's hired a chef. Tell me about what led to this decision.
Yeah, so we have hired a chef, Mike, his name is. He's amazing. We opened a school in Melbourne this year. We've only been open since January, and our school meals program has been up and running since September. So we're still early days. But the decision came about early on. Obviously, I was familiar with a lot of the research around the benefits of having school meals in schools. So I really wanted to think about how we could do that from the ground up, starting a new school. I also was lucky enough to travel overseas and see it in action in other countries. So just thought I'd give it a go this year after speaking with members of the community as well. We knew that it would be a valuable contribution to the students and families at my school.
So what's on the menu today? What kind of things are the kids eating?
Well, it's a curriculum day here today, so there's no kids at school. But depending on the day, sometimes it's lamb kofta with rice and vegetables, beef bolognese, pulled chicken with flatbread and veggies or salad, lots of curries. I think Friday we had sticky lamb noodles. And we also have a vegetarian option every day because we have a very multicultural school community. So we have a main option and a veggie option to ensure that all children at our school have a choice.
It sounds delicious. It sounds amazing. Who's paying for it?
Parents at the moment. So obviously Victorian schools are the least funded schools in the country, so we can't afford to pay for it out of our school budget. However, our parents contribute $5 per day per child to ensure that we can provide those meals. And many of the parents in my community have said that they're now spending less on food than what they were before.
Interesting. Well, Rebecca Golley, you're the nutrition and dietetics expert in the chat. Listening to Beck telling us about the school, the chef that they've got, it's actually not the only Aussie school that's hiring a chef. You've been studying similar programs elsewhere.
Correct. So a couple of examples from different states around Australia. So we've got a partnership with the School Food Project, which has been founded by passionate chef Theanna Peters. And Flinders has been involved in the setup and evaluation of a chef-led program at Berrima Primary School in the New South Wales Southern Highlands. Again, the school community has gotten behind this program, and similar to Victoria, they've repurpose the money that families are already spending on lunchboxes each day, but instead children there are eating together, and for, you know, similar $5 a day for morning tea, lunch and afternoon tea. Their food's prepared by former MasterChef contestant and renowned chef Sarah Knights. And in South Australia, we've been working for a long time, over 3 years, with SA chef Duncan Wedgemold and his restaurant Africola Canteen, and also a local catering company called The Prep House. So these programs, these chefs are feeding nearly 1,000 Aussie school kids high quality, nourishing school food each week. And they're, you know, there's really a network of chef-led programs emerging around the country.
This is Life Matters on ABC Radio National. I'm Tegan Taylor with Beck Spink, who's the Wiradjuri Primary School Principal, and Rebecca Golley, who's a Professor of Nutrition and Dietetics at Flinders University, talking about school lunches. And I asked you before what was in your lunchbox. Well, I sort of started sharing without invitation what was in my school lunchbox as a kid. On the text line, someone says, remember roll-ups? Not sure of what nutrition value they were, but they were the fave in the 90s. Rebecca, I'm thinking about what I see on social media. It feels like kids these days are going to school with bento boxes, and it's all very healthy compared to the roll-ups that this texter and I would have chowed down on in the 90s. But that's really hiding a pretty worrying trend about how many kids are going to school without lunch at all.
Yeah, correct. So at the moment, Australia, we're in the middle of a perfect storm that's been building up over the last few decades. You know, we can have fond memories of foods like, you know, muesli bars and roll-ups, but this type of convenience food that's highly packaged, highly processed, you know, that is becoming the norm. I've seen lunchboxes with, you know, 4 or 5 packets of chips with 2 parents working. Sometimes that becomes the norm. But again, if you dig deeper, we're finding that the cost of living pressures means that families are having to find nearly $1,000 per child per year for the school lunchbox. So the squeeze on the family budget, we're seeing increasing numbers of children attending school each day with empty lunchboxes. It's up over, you know, 1.3 million children around Australia, and the number of children coming to school with no lunch has increased by 28% since 2022.
And you're seeing teachers paying for kids' lunches out of their own pockets.
Yeah, so schools do everything they can. Like schools, every principal and school community I talk to, the children's welfare and readiness to learn is their top priority. So they do use their sort of social justice, or, you know, a bit of money to, you know, support schemes like Food Bank and Eat Up to be able to access those sort of food relief models. But the stories of teachers chipping in so that they can have, you know, white bread, Vegemite, a piece of fruit available, you know, they go above and beyond every day just to make sure that kids have something in their bellies to help them stay engaged and ready to learn.
Beck, you were saying before that you've really had this as part of your school from the very beginning. Maybe you can't compare, but what does it mean in the classroom to know that every kid at school has had a proper round meal, square meal, whatever shape the meal's meant to be?
Healthy, nutritionist meal. Sure. It It is, you know, for us, it's still early days. Even though our school opened in January, we only started the program in September. But the impact we're already seeing is really positive. Children are really excited about getting their morning tea, lunch and afternoon tea every day. Teachers know that children have had a good lunch. And, you know, a lot of the time we're seeing calmer behaviours coming in and out, transitioning and things like that. But again, still early days. So I'm looking forward to seeing how that evolves as we continue on.
On the text line, one person says, as a 10-year-old in 1974, I went to a school in London that served hot dinners at lunch every day. It cost 72 pence a week. 72 pence a week. Oh, my gosh. It was great and a response to a lot of kids coming from families with financial challenges. Rebecca, is Australia lagging behind the world when it comes to providing school lunches?
We are. We're one of the only very few developed countries globally that doesn't have a national school lunch program. You know, the experiences that we're seeing both in New Zealand and Canada at the moment, where they have traditionally used canteens and lunchboxes as the primary way that kids have food at school, they are transitioning now to introducing national school lunch programs. Back in 2006, I worked for a UK organisation called the School Food Trust, and, you know, from a public health nutrition perspective, a national lunch program, you know, it addresses equity, it addresses food insecurity, it supports health, education, you know, it really gives kids that sort of foundation and connection at school to then be ready to engage in their learning, which is good for all Australians.
What would it take to fund and roll out a national school lunch program, though?
I think what I've learnt from my international experience and, you know, the people I'm talking to or understanding the Australian context is that, you know, we can't have this set up as being 100% government funded. It needs government coordination. It does need government investment for things like kitchen infrastructure. But then that needs to be supported across all of the departments that are going to benefit: agriculture, social services, sort of training and economic development, health and education. But we also need to understand that parents and industry also have a role to play. There's a new workforce that's needed, but that actually is opportunities. We could have apprenticeships, training in schools. We can have, you know, local volunteer or employment programs to get that workforce of that sort of dining room role. We can also work with industry to go, well, you know, how do we have different models that work for different schools? So everyone's got a role to play. And, you know, I guess what we're seeing with schools like in Victoria and Berrima and here in South Australia at Annesley Junior School, what we are finding is that a whole system can be, you know, built from the ground up. And then if we did have that sort of national coordination, that great learning and that network of information sharing can really fast track Australia into a better position. Mm.
Rebecca, Beck, thank you both so much for joining me. Beck Spink is the principal of Werribee Primary School in Victoria, and Rebecca Golley is a professor of nutrition and dietetics at Flinders University. On the text line, Duke in Nambucca says Nambucca Heads High School has the best canteen. Shout out to Chef Haley. And another says lunch in the 1950s was dryish bread and leftover mutton or cheese with no salad, and the occasional treat of leftover fish and chips partially heated on the wood stove heater. Doesn't sound quite as appetizing to me as a grown-up these days, but maybe it did taste good back in the day. That is almost all I've got time for today with you here on Life Matters, coming to you from Jagera and Turrbal Land. Earlier in the show, it was talking about aged care and what changes the Aged Care Act, which came into effect on Saturday, are actually going to have. One person says, I'm a registered nurse with 35 years experience. I worked in aged care when training 35 years ago in a government-run home, again some 25 years ago in a private but well-run home, and a few years ago for a few days. I was horrified that there was only one registered nurse for over 100 patients, and the enrolled nurses are risked to death, as are the care assistants. It's an appalling system, this person says. Residents can't possibly get decent care under these staffing ratios. Thank you, Jenny in Hobart, for that text. We also spoke about early childhood care, the other end of the spectrum. Joanne asks, how does the expectation to stop, take and send photos to parents impact on the care educators are trying to provide to children? Well, that is almost it for Life Matters, coming to you today from Jagera and Turrbal Land. Tomorrow on the show, we are going to talk about e-bikes. We had a conversation a week or so ago about taking back the streets for play and pedestrians, and you would not stop sending me texts about e-bikes, how fast they can go, the safety problems that you see with them. We're getting stuck into it tomorrow. Stick around for that, and you can email me anytime, lifematters@abc.net.au, and I'll catch you tomorrow.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.